Another thing about counseling is it's not a debate. If you're feeling that you have to persuade them, then that's another sign that you're a little bit off. You may have to say it more than once, but if your mind ever shifts to trying to persuade them, that tells you that I have to back up from this and just say it. If they're not recognizing what I'm saying, if they may say, oh, that sounds interesting to me, explain that to me again, or what did you quite mean? I didn't quite understand that part. That's quite different. But when you're mustering all your arguments and telling them why it's the right thing and knowing inside that you have to break down their resistance to what you're saying, unless you have absolute certainty that this isn't divinely inspired, it's probably a disaster. There are times, and believe me, you have to be very careful about them, when you feel perfectly calmly inside yourself that you really have to speak strongly. But usually it doesn't take much if that's what you feel. But if there's any sense that I really need to say this, I have to get this off my chest, who are we serving at that point? So you sit, you listen very, very carefully. I not so long ago, had this conversation with someone. The person came to me. I think that they talked for about 90 minutes, and I never said a word. And I'll talk to you in just a moment about how to listen. And the more they described their life situation, the more I thought, I don't have anything to say. I can't think of a thing to say. And then the very last 5 minutes just popped into my head. And, you know, I just offered a few thoughts, and boom, everything shifted in that moment. I mean, you know, the amount of time that they talked, the amount of time I talked was like this. I had no idea of what to do. But I just waited and waited. And if nothing had come to me, I would have just said, well, this is a tough time for you. We're here to help you. But in the last moment, you know, just this thought occurred to me. Very casually it occurred to me. And I just offered it in that same vein. And everything came together. But it wouldn't have happened if there had been any anxiety in between. Now, about how to listen, you know, it takes a lot of energy to listen. We have to really, really listen. I think eye contact is extremely important, unless it freaks people out to look at them. But you should look at them in a very natural manner. But the soul is revealed through the eyes. And while people are listening, talking, it's extremely important to be genuinely interested in them. You know, and if you're not genuinely interested, you need to excuse yourself. Because if someone talks to you intimately and is revealing themselves and you don't really care, you'll really hurt them. So you have to really muster yourself. I often tell people, you know, when they'll call at an inconvenient hour or ask to speak to me when they know I might be, quote, busy, although I say if nobody asks to talk to me, I really don't have anything to do, so I'm not busy. But I know if I'm overloaded and I'm not going to be able to be genuinely interested because I'm either too preoccupied or too busy. And I know then that I'll do more harm than good, and so I'll always find a way to extricate myself from it. You know. Now, sometimes right in the middle of a conference with someone, you may feel your mind wandering or your fatigue level creeping up or your judgmental nature rising. Because what you have to do when you're listening to people is you have to be very deeply inwardly connected to an awareness higher than your own ego. And even as you're looking at the person, and you don't need to do this in any extremely pretentious way. It's something that you should gradually, by practicing all the time, it's something that you should integrate into your own nature. That while you're listening to someone, you should feel a great deal of love for them and respect and a sense of marveling how this person is, you know, the karmic situation that they're dealing with. And isn't it astonishing what God asks of us? And how remarkable that you would be facing these extremely difficult problems, you know, that, you know, I myself, for example, may never have experienced anything like this. And yet, look, you're having to go through this. You know, just this inward conversation with them, even if you're not saying a word, that's just very engaged in the extreme importance of what this person is telling you. And the privilege of them opening their lives to you, and the marvel of human life. Just how amazing it is that this person would be having these experiences. And you're not saying a word, but a person is feeling all of that. And so your consciousness is completely directed toward them. And that's, like as I was saying earlier with this other counseling experience I had, that I would not have been able to be as calm in, you know, a few years ago. I just knew that if I just stayed with them while they talked, that if anything was required of me, it would emerge from that. I didn't have to be at all concerned about my role in it, that if I just stayed with them, whatever I could contribute would be given to me to contribute. Yes, Sharon.
I was given some good advice from a credible source, and it was wow, and mm-hmm. I did it. And the advice was, because people come to network with seniors, uh-huh. and they, they're isolated sometimes,
right.
and they just need someone to talk to or someone right. to listen. So my comment was, I said, yeah, but they take a lot of my energy. She says, her comment was, well, sometimes you don't listen. And so she says, here's what you do. She would give them 100% of yourself for 5 minutes. Huh. And you listen completely intently
uh-huh.
to what they say. And then I got to get back to work.
Yeah, exactly.
And so uh-huh. if you want to do it, it's easy. But if you don't want to do it and it takes your energy, either way, it opens you up and it's so rich, stuff you would have never thought about or connections you would have never made.
Yeah.
It's like a wow.
I found that, I actually said this to my own husband at one point, because, men and women are different in this respect. Women can multitask and men, as a rule, don't. The male mind doesn't multitask, the female does, which means, as I put it to him, he and I are, I wouldn't call us business partners, but we do this project together, and we've worked together for the last 22 years. And when he's talking to me about some practical matter of what we're doing, he's talking to me about that practical matter. I, by contrast, never forget that he's my husband and I'm his wife. Whereas when I'm being his wife, he's my husband, we do that. And then when we're doing, quote, business together, we're business partners. I, of course, am always his wife. It makes a big, huge difference in the way we relate. And so I pointed that out to him. And then I said to him once, I said, you have no idea how little effort it would take on your part to keep me totally content. I'm not really high maintenance. But if you don't do that tiny bit, then I will get completely off center and it will cause you endless grief. And to his enormous credit, he integrated into his life that little tiny bit that was required, and then we mostly get along just beautifully because I really don't take much. Now, I learned this back at the beginning of when I was Swami Kriyananda's secretary, which I was for a few years in my early years. And during the period of time I was his secretary, for the few years that I did it, he was mostly in a state of semi-seclusion writing his autobiography, The Path. And therefore, and also because at Ananda Village at that time there were no telephones. And there was only one phone, but Swami lived where he still lives, over the hill on the other side. And so there was no way easily to communicate with him. No computers, no email, no electricity for that matter, now that I think about it. So, and I worked in this office where there was a phone where people could find me. So anybody who wanted to see him had to come first to me. So I became his face to the public, which of course was incredible training ground. And sometimes after classes, when he was available, he would say, if you would like to speak to me personally, speak to Asha and she'll make an appointment for you. So I would stand there and people would come around and what they wanted from me had nothing to do with me. They wanted access to him, but I was the gatekeeper. And so how I treated them essentially was how they felt about Swami. So Swami had to do a lot of teaching of me, as he put it. The first thing he put to me is, you're protecting my convenience, which I appreciate, but I'm not interested in my convenience. I'm interested in their welfare, and you must be interested first in their welfare, and only secondarily in my convenience. You have to behave as I would behave, which was, very important. The second thing I realized was all I had to do was actually give people my attention. And all I had to do, even sometimes, was put my hands on their shoulders and say, I really can't talk to you right now, but if you would just wait a few minutes, I will. And if I just did that, and for one whole interchange, no matter how short, I was entirely present, then they would always feel content.
And that's respect.
That's respect. And it was also just mastering my own sense of anxiety. So you're right. You don't necessarily have to give people attention for a long time. You can just say, and sometimes it's good to say in advance, I only have a couple of minutes right now, but tell me about it. And then for those few minutes, just really be there. And then sometimes you even have to interrupt, which is why I often find if you put your hand on someone, if that's appropriate, you can put your hand on them, which is another way of saying, I'm really here, And then you say, you know, I really want to hear the rest of this, but right at this minute, I just don't have time. Or I would say, you can say things also like, this is very important and I want to hear it, but I'm being distracted because I know someone's waiting in my office for me. And then they feel like, you know, not that you're leaving them, but that you really want to be with them, but it's so unfortunate that you can't be. And there's just so many different ways to say exactly the same thing. But if you say it like this, well, I can't talk to you right now. I have to go over there. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it is, it takes so little time, actually, to genuinely relate to someone. Whereas if in your anxiety about time you don't, that's where I was talking about my husband, you don't, then it just rolls on and on and on and on.
And it's love in the eyes.
It's love in the eyes, and it's respect, and it's genuinely, and but you must be. When we just, well, actually, I'll let you speak. Go ahead.
Well, I finally got, came back to me. Uh-huh. Earlier, you were talking, how can you tell if this, is there karma to go through it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like.
As opposed to
try to help him, and it's this, you know. I mean, you're trying to help him, but how do you know, well, is there karma? They have to go through this anyway, no matter what?
You can't know. So you have to take it a step at a time and see what kind of inner signals you get. And I'll come back to it. If you feel agitated, afraid, anxious, concerned, and I'm looking at both of you who have children and you're talking about your children, your anxiety has nothing to do with their welfare. And especially between parents and children, especially when the children are the ages of your children, your parents' anxiety is like so irrelevant. It just means so nothing to you. My nephew was very, very helpful to me once when we were talking about something or another. And I responded to him in a kind of, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? What are you going to do then kind of energy? And I was not pleased with my response because it came out of a sense of inner agitation, I could tell. And I have a very vivid memory of many of not of my young childhood, but from about 15 on, of significant interchanges. I have a very vivid memory. I remembered some very significant interchanges with my father when I was at that time exactly the same age as my nephew was. And I was about to move out on my own, and I was about to take this apartment, and, you know, all this stuff. And my plans were a little less than practical. How I was actually going to, what job I was going to do, whether I would have enough to pay my bills, what would happen here, what would happen there. You know, it all was a little vague in concept. And so my father was trying to help me see how it was vague. And I was like so, and it was his anxiety. It was his anxiety that something would happen to me. It was his anxiety that he would have to pick up the pieces. You know, those were the two things that were motivating him. But he loved me. It wasn't a bad thing. It was his anxiety because he was losing control of me and he was attached to me. All of those things were there. And my first response was just like, leave me alone. But the other thing I understood, which was the most important, was he was older than me and he didn't have as much energy as me. And so those things for him would have been a big problem, but for me they weren't, because I was so energetic and I was so indifferent to so many things that were important to him. I wasn't worried about security, I wasn't worried about inconvenience, I wasn't worried about having to sleep on the couch of my friend's apartments. I wasn't worried about having to ride my bike and having my car break down. None of those things, which to him, at his age, with his responsibilities, would have been big problems, were not problems at all to me. They were just part of the adventure of being 19 and 20 years old. And even though he was right, and I could vaguely see he was right, it didn't loom in my mind as a problem. And that's what my nephew said to me. I went back to my nephew and I apologized to him, and I said all this to him because we have a very clean relationship. And he said, yeah, he said, and he was talking about his own parents. And of course there's, you know, the element of sheer stupidity, which young people also have, to give credit to my sister and her husband, who may hear this tape. But he said to me, he said, they don't appreciate how much energy and creativity I have to solve whatever problem comes. They do appreciate his lack of experience, and they, unfortunately, having raised him, have seen him come a cropper quite a few times, and this is the transition age here. But still, that phrase, they don't understand how much energy and creativity I have to solve this problem. And I said, of course they don't, because they're not 19 anymore. They're 50 and 55, and their stage of life is completely different. Now, where does that come from? Oh, that, where that comes from is, You really have to see it from the point of view of the person you're talking to. And whether or not it's their karma, you have to also understand whether this is really a problem for them or whether it's just a problem for you. And whether it's their karma or not will be determined by them, not by you. But your anxiety about it happening is a sure sign that you need to back off, that you have ceased to be helpful. And as soon as, there's a phrase that I call talking down the tube. You have to always watch and very sensitively inward and feel whether the person you're talking to is still with you. And the instant you know that, as I call it, you're talking down a tube, which you've begun to back way up, and now you're trying to reach them down this long tube that could be a foot away from you, but they have psychically just abandoned the conversation. And they're looking at you like this, just waiting for you to stop. At that instant, close your mouth and do not open it again. Because it's worse than not helpful. And Swamiji puts it this way, he says, a good leader never backs a lost cause. Because if you're backing a lost cause, you the people whom you're responsible for will lose respect for you. And if they lose respect for you, even when you're right, they will stop listening to you because they will just think of you as somebody who just blows in the wind. So a lot of times in the course of conducting Ananda, my position, Swami's position, there'll be a very good idea that needs to be dealt with, but he won't deal with it because it's not timely to solve it. And he's not going to put himself out there and fail. I mean, it's just strategic, because if he consistently fails, people will think of him as a leader who doesn't know what he's doing. If you talk to your kids in such a way that they always know that you're just talking from your point of view and not theirs, they totally lose respect for you. And you can tell whether it's your children. Children sometimes are very easy to see. But you can see with anyone. I mean, I'll often be talking to someone and I can just tell suddenly they left me. They either left me because I'm off, or they left me because something more compelling came into their mind. At such point, I'll always stop and say, do you have a thought? Are you with me? Or I just felt you leave. If I really did, although that sometimes is a little intimidating. But just somewhere or another, you have to stop. And then find a way, because talking and communicating are not the same thing. And parents talk endlessly and only rarely communicate. I was told, it's true. Tim Shantz, who used to be a teacher at Ananda Village School, I was told this about him, this is a story, and I didn't hear it from him, so I assume it's true. I was actually told that he never repeated himself, that he would only give instructions to his children once. Now, of course, this was after a lot of building up of confidence. Maybe he would only speak twice. But the story that was told to me was once he was trying to get a child to stay in his chair, and the child was not staying in his chair, so he walked over and got a staple gun and stapled the child's jacket to the desk. And it was just, I mean, he could do that because of the whole context, but it was like he wasn't going to waste words. Because if you constantly talk when people are not listening, they never listen to you. And you feel demeaned. And that makes you feel impotent, you feel demeaned, you feel not respected, which makes you anxious, and it just goes to hell in a handbasket right after that. And if that's where you are with anyone in your life, I suggest you shut up now and start a new reality where you speak when you're communicating. When you're not communicating, you listen, you encourage the other person to talk, and you make what I call sympathetic clucking noises. Swami Kriyananda is very great at going, ah. Very like, the Indians often shake their head like this and go, acha, acha, like that. I said, Swamiji, what does that mean? He says, well, it essentially means I exist, you exist. It's just totally, and so you're engaged. And because people want to know that you're still, you know, when you talk and talk and nobody says a word, you say, are you still there?
Yeah.
You know, is it still happening? So you have to, and so I've really mastered sympathetic clucking noises, which let people know. And you say things like, wow, interesting, amazing. Hmm. And it's not a put-on. It's just you are responding, but verbal response, conceptual response is not appropriate. But you want the person to know that you're still really there with them. Hmm. Yeah, wow, that's amazing. That really happened. Hmm. You know, like that. Or you ask little questions like, and so what did that mean? You know, how did you feel about that? And that's a different kind of leading. You're leading when you're doing that. But just if you're not communicating, shut up. Absolutely no good will be done, and a great deal of damage will be done. Even in the middle of a sentence. As soon as they're gone. Sometimes what's really fun is when they've stopped listening and you stop talking to see if they notice. One husband actually said to the wife, when she complained that he wasn't listening, he said, "If I listened to everything you said, I would never get any work done." Which was the truth. Painful truth. But well spoken and timely. It was an appropriate remark. Because the wife was talking down a tube. The husband might have put a little more energy out, but nonetheless, the wife was talking down a tube, and she just needs to be quiet. Okay? Let's take a short break now, then we can come back. The next phase of this? Let's see. Does anyone remember where we were? Let me see if I can remember where we were. I was talking so much.
You were talking about sympathetic clucking noises.
Sympathetic clucking noises. Okay. So, all right. Now... Oh, good. Is anyone else cold? Are you cold, Kimmer?
I do. Thank you.
Okay. Are you cold? No. Okay. There's other shawls out on the shelf. Okay, great. Yeah, exactly. The steward comes in and offers us, next he'll be offering us vegetarian meals. Okay. Let's see now.
Last section, we talked about karma.
Pardon me?
The karma.
Okay, you were asking the karma,
yeah,
of how you can tell. Okay, that's where I thought we were. And this is a direct answer to your question, Edwin, how can you tell if it's someone's karma? Here's something that I've found to be enormously helpful. If you're not certain, you know, somebody's talking to you and you're not certain of what to say, it seems self-evident, but the obvious thing is to pray. And you can just pray to Master or Divine Mother or whatever spirit works for you while somebody's talking to you, you're looking right into their eyes and you think to yourself, Master, what would you like me to tell them? You know, what is it that I should say? And even if, Sharon, for example, a thought comes strongly into your head to say, you can't always be certain immediately what level that thought is coming from, especially if one has an inclination to act from one's own anxieties or self-interest and not entirely from a purely impersonal sense of divine service, no matter how strongly the thought comes, it's a very good idea to just pause for a moment and inwardly ask, Master, would this be helpful for me to say? Is this something you want to say? Don't ask the question, is this right? Is this true? Say, is this what you want them to hear right now? Now, I've had, and it more than once, had the experience of having a clear, wonderful idea, pausing long enough to say, Master, do you want them to hear it? Having the idea completely disappear from my mind and never occur to me again till days or weeks later. Because it was like so not what should be said that God took it way out of my head.
It's trusting and letting it go.
Yeah, well, it wasn't even like I had a choice. It was like I made that prayer and then I forgot I even prayed. I mean, God didn't want to mess around with me. He just took it away completely, because it really was not helpful. It was only true. It wasn't helpful. You see, that's the enormous distinction you have in your mind. You can't say, is this true? Is this right? Is this accurate? Is this what would help them? Once I was in a situation where I was trying to persuade someone to do something, and Swamiji heard that I was trying to persuade, which that was before I understood that if you're trying to persuade, you're wrong. And he said, we were in a conversation. I said, well, don't you agree that it would be really good for him if he would just go in this direction? Swami said, of course. You know, he gave me the credit for not being an idiot. Of course, he said. But you have to wait until he sees it himself. Because now it's just your point of view. It doesn't resonate with his reality. And if it doesn't resonate with his reality, it doesn't make any difference how right you are. It has to be his own next step. He's the baby in the womb, and he has to just be ready for it. So, oh, that's right. So now I no longer think whether I'm right. I think whether or not it's something that they're ready to hear. And if they're not ready to hear, just forget it, sweetheart. It's just a total waste of your time. You should save your breath, and you should not diminish your own magnetism by dumping unwelcome ideas on people, because you will get a reputation as someone who doesn't know what they're talking about. instead of a reputation who's always just right on and let me go talk to him or her because they really can help me. See how different that is? Now, the other thing that I found astonishingly helpful is you can, and the way I would phrase it is this, and this is something, and I have to be fair to this is not something that Swami Kriyananda ever said to me or that I've ever read anywhere, but this is how I articulate it to myself. Every person knows, they have their own two levels too. They have the divine level, the soul level, which is really sort of guiding the experience, and then they have the ego level, what they think they're doing. And I guess you would say also there's the karmic level. There's all of the energy that's in place and all of the momentum that's just going to have to fulfill itself. And what the person thinks about what's happening is only part of it. What you think about it is only even less. But there's soul wisdom, there's destiny, and then there's the ego trying to relate to their own experience. And the soul always knows God is in charge. As Swamiji remarked, in fact, it was in that same little fundraising brochure speech, he said, the world seems to be falling to pieces, but don't worry, God is in charge. So when you see someone who seems to be falling to pieces, don't worry, God is in charge of their destiny. Whatever's happening to them is what's supposed to happen, and they're being inwardly guided. Now, they may be inwardly guided, you have to realize this, to make their own situation so horrible that they'll be motivated to change.
How bad is bad?
Yeah, you can't say that God is in charge and therefore everything's going to work out just fine. It may not work out fine at all. It may end in a total catastrophe. But you have to redefine the word fine. Because what is trying to happen in all circumstances is every individual is on the trajectory of their own karma, and the purpose of that karma is for them to learn necessary lessons about divine law and where happiness really comes from, what actions cause suffering and what actions produce happiness. And the reason they're in whatever situation they're in is because all those forces are coming together to teach them something very specific. You see, this is what I saw about my parents. And I would add, I never actually finished this, my prayer for my parents changed. I re-channeled my anxiety into this, Lord, I don't know what it is you're trying to teach them, but you really better help them to learn it. And I actually more calmly would pray, Divine Mother, give them the courage, the wisdom, and the receptivity to learn whatever it is they're supposed to be learning now. Courage, receptivity, and whatever the other word I said was.
Wisdom.
To learn whatever it is they're trying to learn. And I didn't put on that, they're trying to learn this. Help him to understand he shouldn't drink. Help my mother to understand she should be more trusting. Help my father to be less controlling. I didn't say any of that, because how do I know? I said, help them to learn whatever it is that they're supposed to learn. Give them the qualities to be able to learn it. And I prayed that prayer with all the anxiety I had been using to try to force my will on their destiny. Mm-hmm. Because I had to do something with my energy. Because it wasn't a matter of, just be detached. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just like no option. There was all this, so I had to be directed. So I directed it in what I could only call a very fierce prayer. And even in the moment when I was with them, if I felt like reacting, instead I took that energy and I had these very serious conversations with God about it. Look at this. You know, you really have to help these people. You know, I would say, I'm close to the end of my strength here, and you have really got to help them because I can't go through this much longer. You know, and that was an honest statement. I can't handle this, so you have to help. And he did. You know, he helped. I could feel it. I could feel, without being able to quantify it, I could feel the effect of those prayers just happening.
For it's so natural and just unfolds.
And it unfolds natural. Because it's their karma, and they're going to follow through. And when you can be absolutely certain that they're going to follow their karma. I mean, you can't, just like if you think about that, of course they're going to follow their karma, and whether it is or isn't, you have no way of knowing, but what difference does it make? If what you're praying is that Divine Mother guide their lives, give them the courage and the wisdom and the receptivity to learn what they have to learn, what difference does it make to you how they learn it? It's only your opinion as to how they should learn it. Their soul knows, and what I was finally coming to in this is, if I'm really anxious and confused and need to do something and don't know what to do, I often pray to the person I'm trying to help. I pray to their super consciousness. And even sometimes when I'm looking right at someone, I'll be thinking in my own awareness, could you please tell me what it is that you want from me? You know, can you tell me what it is that you need from me? And I'm not asking their ego. I'm asking their soul. Would you please communicate with me? And I've often used that when I'm outside their company. I'll meditate and I'll bring that person to mind and I'll ask their superconscious to tell me what it is that they need that I can do to help them. A friend of mine was telling me, I'd suggested this to her, and she was in a very difficult relationship and very, very strong measures were required from her. And she felt like the superconscious of this person who was making her life miserable said, you should fight me with all your strength. And she really felt it was a true answer. And that was what the superconscious was saying to her. That's what I really need here. It's not what my ego's asking for, but that's what I really need from you. And that just put everything in order for her. Yes?
A long time ago, uh-huh. I spoke with David, because there was a period about anxiety because of the work that I do.
Right.
I work in a hospital center. And he recommended, I was not happy there.
Right.
And then he's recommended to have Master picture
uh-huh.
and find it in one of my pockets. Uh-huh. So I left that pocket for Master.
Uh-huh.
And when I was going, because you find out type of personalities every day. And it happened now, I don't read the picture anymore.
Uh-huh.
Master with me.
Uh-huh.
So when, and now also I'm working with people who's not going to have more than 5 years of uh-huh. you know, being here.
Right.
Some others next month or 3 days.
Uh-huh.
Just
we
work in oncology, cancer, people with cancer and people who are just dying.
Uh-huh.
So I just, and I have 5 minutes to go in and out. It's just
right.
that span of time, so I really
right.
want me to concentrate.
Yeah.
And also because of those 5 minutes, I become very unattached. I don't get involved.
Right.
With too much, but I see the part that I have to take care of the body, physical
right.
part, and I see the other part that I is my most interest,
right.
the soul level. So, and I, there is a lot of grief in a hospital in the sense that people is all me.
Yeah.
Whether oxygen, food, pain, it just
yeah.
they want me to be just with them.
Right.
I have to divide the time. So every time I feel that I want to reach someone, I go with Master, help me. But
yeah.
I do it in kind of a fast way.
Yeah.
And Master know that is, I totally, of course, respect him, but it's just more like,
yeah, exactly.
come with me, just help me help.
Yeah.
So I can reach that person. And I find out that for people who are totally clueless, humor is the key.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps me.
That's
and so it's the only way that I can kind of go in. For instance, there was a woman who, beside of needing oxygen, she needed a lot of attention.
Yeah.
So everyone who went into her room, she would play the same show that
yeah.
she was short of breath, and
yeah.
we would call 3 or 4 different specialists just to go to her room. So one time, I said to her, and I leave them with a question,
yeah.
and I leave the room.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "This is so interesting to me. You just need oxygen. You guys oxygen all the time." And I practice every day to become breathless. What are you talking about? Oh, I'm sorry, I was not talking to you. I was talking to your soul. But I come back. You're calling me, I come back. And then if I come back
uh-huh.
and they talk, they kind of continue with the topic,
uh-huh.
it's because they need to know about it, according to me.
Exactly. And that's very, very good, Anna. That's, mm-hmm. yeah, that's very good.
And yeah. I have to come back because she
yeah.
did the show, so next time she did the show again.
Uh-huh.
And I was pretty attentive to her, okay, I called everyone
uh-huh.
I did,
uh-huh.
so she was in the
uh-huh.
mood again. And then she started talking about, what do you mean with the soul? Well, yeah, and then there we go.
Yeah, excellent.
So it's to me, like, okay, this person's gonna be with us for almost a year, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it's gonna be a way for her to go in that direction.
Just excellent. Yeah, superb.
So that's the way kind of I work with people now.
Yeah.
The ones that, there's another lady, probably today or tomorrow is going to be her last day.
Uh-huh.
And 2 weeks ago, she was worried about her house payment.
Uh-huh.
And I just said to her, what you are so concerned. But I also have to be very careful because people are in denial.
Yeah.
And the full family is in denial. Yeah. So I said, I wouldn't worry about your house. It would be nice if you go with some place and there is sunlight over there and you, I don't know, just to leave this place and just go with all your family members. They can take you there. The house payment, kind of I said to her, somebody else will have to take care of that.
Yeah.
You just take care of it.
You know, Anna, what you're suggesting is, I'll may articulate it in a more specific way, is you offer a little bit and then see how the person responds.
Yeah.
And instead of debating, I don't think I quite finished that thought, instead of debating and presenting all your arguments at once, you bring up the topic and see if there's interest. And if there's interest, then you offer something else. And if there's a receptive response, then you offer something else. And at the point at which the door closes, you stop. This story is not in the book, my book about Swami. I never could exactly write it up properly, but if I write a second volume, I'll try to get it in. Swami taught me to cook. He taught me how to cook by just awakening some intuitive understanding of it that I didn't have. And I was cooking at that time. I was the main cook for the community at the meditation retreat, which was where most of us lived. I was a terrible cook. I was a very healthy cook, but everything I cooked just tasted really blech, like this. And at first, I didn't care if it was, because it was healthy, it didn't matter to me. But then I wanted it to be better, and I didn't know how to make it better. I even could follow a recipe, and it still wouldn't come out. I have no idea why. So Swamiji said to me, and there was this house revolt happened because nobody had their own kitchens. They had to eat what I cooked, and I cooked almost all the meals, and it was getting to be a real problem for everyone. I myself, and still to this day, if it's healthy, it tastes good to me, but I know that's not true for everyone. So he said to me after some event, he said, you know, that main dish was, it seemed just a little bland to me. You know, sort of like a question mark, like, am I the only one who thought it was bland? I said, oh, I know, it did come out bland. And then I said, I tried to make it more tasty, but it just came out bland. He said, you know, sometimes the dishes you make are bland. And I said, yes, sir, that's true, and I'm just working on it, but I can't seem to figure out how. And see, if at any point I had denied what he was saying or had shown myself unreceptive, that would have been the end of the conversation. But he opened the door, I stepped through it. He opened another door, I stepped through that. So he finally said, would you like me to teach you to cook? And he never said, this community is just having a fit because you're such a terrible cook. You know, I'm just getting so many letters and they're coming to me in delegations. What are we going to do? Which was really the truth. It was just like, are you willing to learn something? And when I showed myself willing, he took me in. And the end of that story is somebody was visiting. He was having another Swami visiting for the weekend. And from Friday to Sunday night, I hosted with Swami this man. And we cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner for this man and about five others. And I just worked with Swami for the whole weekend. And on Monday morning, I knew how to cook. And he never really said anything to me. He just cooked, you know, just threw things in. But he somehow opened my intuition, because the story was so ungrounded, which is why I didn't put it in the book. I couldn't figure out any way to ground it. There seemed no point in just telling a story that was just about me that I couldn't figure out how to universalize. So I made 10 or 12 attempts to universalize that story, and it just came back to being a personal experience, and I just didn't think it was useful. But the useful part of it was, which is the part I wanted to get in, which is the way he dealt with me. And then over many years, I've watched him. There's another story that is in the book about a man who left the community, and he was actually gone about 12 years, and he had this idea in his mind that he should do this other thing. And Swamiji didn't really feel that that other effort would be successful, and he didn't really feel it was the best use of the man's time, but he was determined. And so every time Swami got engaged with trying to help him do this thing that Swami himself didn't even think was, you know, going to ever work out. But out of friendship, he supported him the way he was going. And every time they would meet, because I was usually present, Swami would open the door to a conversation about whether or not it was just time to abandon that project and move back to the main village. And every time the man showed himself, beneath non-receptive, he was oblivious to the fact that Swami was even, you know, opening the door, and would just go through the door that he was determined to go through, and I would watch Swami just kind of sigh and then just go with him. Until after 12 years, everything played itself out, and the man came back and said, I'm thinking of moving back. Swami said, I think that would be a good idea. And not a word of recrimination, nothing, absolutely nothing. It was just, that was the way to do it. Now what that is saying, and this is the principle, in most cases, and only rarely should you take a risk on this, preserving the relationship is a very important value. Because if you break the relationship, your opportunity to help will be gone forever. So sometimes you just have to preserve the relationship and then just wait. Because if you've preserved the relationship, especially against great odds, you will gradually win the person's trust to the fact that you are their friend. And then later, if it's necessary, even to speak harshly, you will be dropping that sternness into a great pool of trust. Whereas if you speak prematurely and break the relationships, you'll probably never be helpful. For Swami Kriyananda particularly, you know, he must preserve the relationship. You know, it just really doesn't matter what people, because he's talking about a relationship that goes over incarnations. So even if this person is just going to blow off this whole incarnation, if Swami can maintain the relationship, then eventually he'll be able to work it out. And you know, but if you lose the relationship, then so much has been lost that can't be resurrected again. And we think that we're not helping people by doing this. I'm going to give you one more example of this. Some of you have heard this story, but it's exactly apt to this situation. I used to have a really strong inclination to procrastinate. I still have seeds of it, but not to the difficulty that I had before. My husband David, from whom I have learned an enormous amount, doesn't even comprehend the concept of procrastination. He has a tremendous amount of control over his energy, and he has a very extremely steady energy. I've lived with him for 28 years, and he's just pretty much the same every day. He just does what he has to do. If it's his duty, he does it. He doesn't think about it. He just goes forward. He's been an incredible example to a lot of us that way. So when we were very early in our relationship, my job at that time was before we lived here. It was when we still lived at Ananda Village. For about 5 years before we moved here, my job was to do essentially what I'm doing now, but I did it as a traveling roadshow because we didn't have... We had a small community. We had a big house in San Francisco. We had small centers in Palo Alto, Sacramento, and San Francisco. And then we had a lot of people who were interested in Seattle and Portland, and then a whole lot of other things. And I used to travel around. And I would promote programs, sometimes through our centers and sometimes just in whole new areas through our contacts. And of course, that's a lot of organizational work, which I know how to do. I really learned, you know, how you go about promoting and blah, blah. Except I always hated to just, you know, finally commit. And I always found writing difficult. So these were obstacles. I found it hard to say that 4 months from now, this is where I'm going to be. Now I don't have any problem with that. But then it was hard for me to tie myself down. And the writing of the promotional material was always a source of anxiety. So I would procrastinate. And of course, because it's a huge domino effect, the more I would delay, the more everything would jam up together and it would get harder and harder. So David, who also has a very good mind this way, seeing what I was doing, could only imagine that I was procrastinating because I didn't understand the implications of procrastination. I mean, how otherwise, why would I hurt myself in this way? Why would I create so much stress for myself? So one day, he tried to help me by explaining to me what a disaster was impending because of my own actions. You see, this is how parents work with their children sometimes, isn't it? But I, being astute about my own nature, and this was, you know, we'd been together a year, so we didn't know each other that well. I explained to him that my problem was not an inability to follow it out. It was fear. It was fear of committing. It was the fear of writing. It was just fear. I was afraid. I had a whole host of fears that were freezing my energy. And so I said, and when you tell me about how terrible things are going to be, that makes me more frozen and more frightened. I said, what you need to say to me is, oh, you're so wonderful, it's just going to be fine. In other words, I need an environment in which I can feel secure, safe, and competent, and then I can overcome my fear. And I just said to myself after that, I thought, my God, that's what everybody needs, isn't it? Most of the time, we don't do what we should do. Now, young people and their parents are something else, because in that case, you often have two completely different sets of values. They're trying to have exciting, interesting adventures, and you're trying to protect them from possible harm. So your agendas are completely different. But a lot of times, person knows exactly what they should do, even wants to do what you're telling them to do, but for one reason or another, they're afraid and anxious and they can't. The best way to get them to do it is not to try to frighten them into doing it, but to create an environment in which they feel safe enough to move forward. And that's where all the everything else that we're saying, that's why a person needs to leave your company feeling stronger and more encouraged than when they came. And even if not a word of practical advice has been given, if they feel stronger and more encouraged, then they'll just do what they should do because it will lessen their anxiety and they'll be able to go toward it. Now, this is not the same as enabling. Enabling is when you're actually insincere in the way you relate to them or too self-interested, the difference. I mean, that's why I was saying at the beginning, there is such a thing as happiness-producing actions and misery-producing actions. If they don't want your words, you have to be absolutely sincere. And this is another point. You must be sincere and honest with people. You cannot shine them on, and you cannot lie to them, because that just destroys the integrity of the relationship. Silence is not a lie. And sometimes you couch your words very carefully. There's a story in the book where this person was determined, where this person was compelled by a certain desire that they had and was going to go forward on a course of action that was not going to work out for them. And in fact, as decades have passed, Swami's understanding was exactly true, and the person ended up feeling quite miserable for a long period of time because of the whole thing. But at the same time, the desire was so strong that their mind was clouded. And so the person was coming to Swami ostensibly for permission, but all they really wanted was approval. So the person said to Swami, you know, would you please bless this? And Swami said, I bless you, I always bless you, like that. And then the person walked away saying, Swami blesses my decision. Now Swami had never actually blessed the decision, but the person was not listening carefully enough. See, you learn with Swamiji, you listen to exactly what he said to you. Because you see, sometimes that's a way of communicating. You say, will you bless my decision? He says, I bless you, I always bless you. If you're listening carefully, you will realize he didn't answer your question. And that's another way of his testing to see how open you are. And if you walk away and say, great, instead of saying, well, then do you have questions about this decision? You see, that would have led to a different conversation. So you have to be creative enough in your mind to be absolutely sincere and speak the truth. So if you are trying to express disagreement, but there's no receptivity to it, you can still say something true that will not break the relationship or diminish the person's energy. Now, sometimes you risk the relationship and sometimes sternness is required, but you have to be very, very careful that you're not acting from your own inner anxiety. And if your inner anxiety is compelling you, then you need to be frank about that. You speak with detachment and respect. Wow, talking to your child, that sure makes me nervous what you're thinking about doing. I just have to say that, it makes me really nervous. You know, but I'm not you, so if you think it's a good idea, I'll try to support you. But you know, I'm going to be scared. Then you've told the person the absolute truth, but you haven't actually put anything on them except an honest communication. So it depends on what the relationship is. If you're just a counselor, you know, they don't care how you feel. How you feel is not the point. Or you can, again, you test the water. You know, I feel certain reservations about what you're saying. You can just leave it at that. And if the person says, oh, well, I can understand that, or I don't, or if they say, what are those reservations? You sort of can move forward, and then you find out whether or not you're talking down a tube or whether you're with someone. But don't be dishonest. Don't ever be tempted to be dishonest. Don't ever violate your own integrity. Nothing comes from that. There's another, be practical in your idealism, and where there is dharma, there is victory. These are Ananda principles. Dharma means right action, righteousness. Where there is dharma, there is always victory. Meaning, as long as you maintain your right relationship to truth and to the divine, it will all work out. If you violate that inside of you, then things get to be a mess. It never comes out right because you've set a disturbance in the force. But your child going off and doing something that's wacky is not necessarily adharmic, because it's their karma. They need to go through it. You're pretending to approve or whatever, or telling them it's wrong when you're just acting from your own. You see how different all that is? So being a counselor is a great responsibility. You have to be very centered in yourself. You have to be in it only for their reality. Okay, anything else now? And the other thing about being anxious, whenever I'm in a hurry and I feel like I have to call them and I have to talk to them now, that's a clue that maybe you should give this a little time. Whenever I would feel it, I would just call somebody right up. And now I say, if I feel like the world can't go on unless I say this, maybe I should wait and see what the world is going to do. And sometimes also, this is another one of those like praying to the superconscious. I'll say to myself, okay, Master, if it would be helpful for me to talk to this person, give me an opportunity to do it. Mm-hmm. And then for the next 6 months, I'll never see them. I'll never be alone. We'll always be, you know, just never, there'll never be a moment to speak. Or the next day, all of a sudden, they'll say, oh, could I have a ride over to the Sangha with you? And all of a sudden, you're sitting in the car. And then even then you say, well, Master, did you bring us together so we could speak? And you ask that question and the person says, oh, I was just wondering what you thought about so-and-so. I mean, these are true stories. These have literally happened to me. And I think, well, I guess I don't need any more signs than this. You know, and then you can speak frankly and respectfully. Yes, Peter.
Just to kind of recap a little. The whole part about going on your own agenda and your own energy
right.
Seems conflict with about 50% of our culture. I'm just thinking of coming from...
Oh, yeah.
Coming from... Okay, more than 50. Coming from an Italian family, for instance, uh-huh. or some other nationality where, you know, the mother is very into it, or Italian families, you know, if I'm not acting on my emotion, then why would I act? You know, and, you know, they want to get in there. So I'm guessing...
As someone said, an Italian friend once who never understood... his spouse, who was not Italian, he said, well, she was never throwing any dishes against the wall, so I didn't know she was upset. Okay, go ahead.
That's the family after all, but, you know, not screaming at each other, you don't love each other.
Exactly.
So my just to recap, you back off on all that stuff except for, you know, one, the very extreme example, you know, the person is going to get hit by a bus.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Then you do that. But, I mean, I'm using an exaggeration because totally back up except, yeah. You know, the bus is coming for so-and-so.
Yeah.
That's just huge. And I don't know where else I was going with that.
No, but Peter, it's definitely right for you to articulate that because... We have a very egocentric culture right now. And so people are talking as if I just please my ego. Now see, it's a reactive stage because on a longer cycle, we've come out of a stage of our culture in which you did the right thing for society. Even if you were miserable in your marriage, you never got divorced. You know, and you always put on the right face. And everything was about keeping the form together. That was Kali Yuga, the age of matter. Everything was about keeping the form together. We had to look right. Now we're into the age of energy. So people are concerned not as to whether it looks right and with external rules, but they're concerned about whether it is right, whether it feels right to me. Now this is actually progress. But the difficulty is the first and most obvious place to ask how it feels is egoic. Does it feel good to my ego? And so we have the false idea that, well, whereas my ego self used to be repressed by society, now I'm not repressed anymore and I get to do whatever I want. And that's actually progress because now, as Swami Kriyananda put it, when he was asked what he thought at the time in the 60s and 70s of what was then called the sexual revolution, when people just sort of took all moral barriers down, and he's from a very orthodox tradition, it would be hard for him to say, you know, hedonism is a great life. But he said, overall, I think it's a good direction. He said, because people are making their own experience the basis of their values. And having your own experience be the basis of your values is a step forward from being compelled by external forces to behave in a certain way without having any inner reality to it. But the next stage after making, of just doing what you want, is to actually begin to ask the question, well, what is really right here? What's dharma, which is another way of saying what actions genuinely produce happiness. And then Swami said in that same discussion, if people are honest about their experience, they will realize that this excessive promiscuity and this excessively materialistic attitude towards sexuality is not really happiness producing. But when they know that, they'll know that from their own experience. Again, in a conversation with my nephew, when he was telling me something about something that had happened at college, And I was just horrified. And I said to him, you actually have no idea how morally reprehensible what you just told me is, do you? And he was just sort of laughing, and he said, no. I said, well, the good news is, I mean, I was having a little trouble with this. He also, we were watching some movie together, which he thought was pretty good, and I thought was just despicable. And I said, you know, not only can I not watch this movie with you, but I can't even have this movie showing in my house. You'll have to just watch it someplace else. It wasn't even extreme. It was just so crude and disrespectful that I couldn't bear it. It wasn't pornographic even. It was just crude and disrespectful. And so I walked away, and because I want to preserve the relationship with him, and because I know he's a person of enormous integrity, he's just who he is. He's, you know, 40 years younger than me and a different generation. I came back and I said, well, here's the great news. I said, whatever moral values you and your generation have will be entirely self-discovered because everything around you is completely debauched. And so debauched, you don't even recognize it as debauchery. But you will, because if you're honest to your own experience, you will gradually discover what's true. Okay, now what's happening is people are thinking, if I can express myself, and if my ego can have what it wants, and if I can declare my needs, and if I can set my boundaries, and if I can express my feelings, then everything's going to be better. And so, especially men and women come together, and everybody goes after their own desires, and everybody fights for their rights, and they all get to get divorced, and then they get to get married again, and then they get to get divorced again, and it just goes on and on and on. And gradually it's beginning to occur to people that maybe there's something fundamentally wrong with this picture. But the good news is, whatever values they have are going to come out of their own suffering, and they're going to find out, instead of always thinking that if I could just break free of this, or not even daring to think that. And so some people who are living really way out their degenerate lives, essentially, sometimes you'll pray for them and they'll get worse, because they just need to push it far enough out that it gets bad enough that they'll turn. And some, that's what I say to people. Well, they're still swimming toward the buoy. They haven't really made the turn yet. And so they're just still, I mean, that's the principle of AA. You have to hit absolute bottom before you're going to want help. And it doesn't have to be AA. It's true about everything. You know, the experience of your present consciousness has to become so bad that the effort required to change it looks less unattractive to you. Mm-hmm. And you will not change. No one will change until that equation has come into balance.
Wow.